G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Good morning, Whitey.
Good morning, Daniel. I'm here. I didn't think I was going to be there for a little while. I suppose I was going to be, but I was looking for something that I couldn't find.
What were we looking for? Your keys. You're looking to drive in and out of the driveway,
right?
Just to feel like old times.
That's right. That has happened many times. No, I couldn't find my laptop, which I use for the Zoom facility.
Oh, yes.
So we can look at each other and talk to each other through the video situation.
Lovingly into my eyes.
That's right. But I'm getting increasingly frustrated by my children and these meetings that they have.
Oh.
So I'm getting pushed out of my own office so my children can have Zoom meetings. So I've got a scenario yesterday where James, who is five, says, "Sorry, Dad, you've got to leave. I've got a Zoom meeting at 11. "Oh, no worries, mate. Yeah, no dramas. And then I've got another one at 1. "Oh, okay. "So you've got to leave. You've got to sort yourself out." And then today, Jemima's got one as well. So Jemima and Campbell have got Zoom meetings today. So I've just got to find alternative arrangements.
Well, you don't need your computer during the day. Come on, you don't need to Zoom during the day, do you? Get the old pen and paper gag. Come on. Come back to old school.
Yeah.
Is there a family desktop situation, or is it just the laptop?
No, there's a family computer type setup. Well, which is in the office. So I've then got to take the laptop and find alternative arrangements. And then this morning I couldn't remember where I put the laptop. So I'm going through the house 5 minutes ago, 7 minutes ago, with a torch, trying to find the laptop. Anyway, I got there in the end.
Well, I would have thought that as you close the day, the night before, you have everything set up, ready to go, so you can just
get
your cup of tea and wander in on the morning.
No.
Preparation.
See, you can imagine last night, Jemima, chest out, three-year-old, walking around going, "I've got a Zoom meeting tomorrow. I've got a Zoom meeting at 11 o'clock. I've got a Zoom meeting." Yeah, no worries. Thanks for that. Great. Wonderful.
Are you getting heckled by your children? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely I am. Every day.
And you're getting upset by the heckling, please, from your children.
No, I just don't like being unsettled. I have my own little thing. I like to be able to shut myself away from everyone and just do my thing. And it's becoming increasingly less possible.
You do leave it to chance a bit.
Anyway. Now, overnight, I've got to cut this straight off the top. James Anderson got to 600 test wickets. And it was another test match that was ruined by rain, but in the end, somehow. Now, it's been a really weird summer in England because there's been a lot of hot and dry weather, but then there's also been a lot of rain whenever they've played test matches. Anyway, he got there. That it didn't look like he was, but he got there and he finishes the test match on 600 test wickets exactly from 156 test matches. Now, the test match was drawn because of the rain late in the test match. But what I want to know is that who are the three other players in test cricket that have gone past the 600 mark? So Anderson now is one of four.
Oh, okay, yes. Well, he's the first seamer, isn't he?
He is, yep.
So you'd have Warnie and Murray.
Yep.
That's pretty straightforward. The third one, that's going to stump me a little bit. It's not a Neil Kumble, is it?
It is. Very good. So, Muralitharan has 800 from 133 test matches. Shane Warne has 708 from 145 test matches. And then Anil Kumble, 619 from 132. So, Anderson in fourth position on 600 exactly, and then Glenn McGrath the next on 563 from 124 test matches. So obviously, from that list, Anderson has played the most test matches, which I think the most impressive part about that is his longevity as a fast bowler to be able to have played 156 test matches across a 17-year span. I think that's quite impressive.
It's very impressive. It's not as if it's been smooth sailing all the way through either. He's had some challenges with his body along the way. So the fact that he's been able to get back all these times and keep taking wickets is absolute testament to the career and the way he prepares himself and gets himself right for action. He's a fantastic bowler, James Anderson.
Yeah, and obviously half he plays, he does a lot better in English conditions than he does elsewhere. He's also played 194 one-day internationals. But, you know, it's like some of the subcontinental spin bowlers and, you know, they're going to do better in those conditions. A lot of Australia's batsmen do better in Australian conditions. Yeah. So, you know, he plays well in his home environment. But,
and the significance of the MCG.
That's right. Richmond plays better at the MCG.
Yeah.
I think the thing with the 600, which made it significant, was that it might be the end, because that is the last Test match of the summer, and you know, there's still conjecture as to whether he's going to retire or not, and they were quite keen for him to get to 600 just in case. Well, in the end, he got to exactly 600. So that happened overnight.
Well, well done to James Anderson. That series 1-0 victory to England, as you said. What else I think you should be impressed about was your inspiration yesterday when we spoke to Ben Dunk. He guided the St Kitts and Nevis Patriots through to a T20 victory, their first one of the calendar, overnight against the Barbados Tritons, who were chasing 151. So a good score to chase. And our man just guided them through the back end of the innings and 22 off 11. Not out, if you don't mind, guided them through for victory with three balls to spare. So I think you should take some credit for that.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I had chatted to him off air and just talked about a few things that he needed to just work on, and it's worked well for him. As he said yesterday, the pressure was on. You know, when it's a sort of owned by some sort of, you know, mogul or whatever they are that own these investor. If things don't go well, they tend to throw the toys out of the cot. So that was an important win. Otherwise, they might have all been going home. Lionel Messi has officially put his transfer request in.
Oh, boy.
So, look, what happens there, I'm not sure. But that's obviously very significant. Arguably the best football player in the world. He's asked one of the arguably the biggest football club in the world, Barcelona, that he wants to go and play his football elsewhere. So, yeah, a couple of interesting things that have happened overnight.
He'll be on his way to the victory. I can see it. I can just see it. That Amy Park's going to be his home for the next 5 years. I can feel it. There'll be a couple of silvers thrown into the deal and a new tracksuit every week. And get to hang out with Grant Brebner, the new coach, at dinner. He'll cook dinner once a week. And that'll be the deal to entice the little master to Melbourne victory. That's a big story in sport, that is. It is a very, very big story. And the chase is now on, although, as we said last week, it does, because he's so good, he does sort of price himself out of the market a bit. A little bit. There's only a couple of clubs that can probably afford him, although, as you rightly point out, how much do you need? Sure,
yeah,
you just
exactly.
Go and play where you want to play.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows?
And then, as part of the deal, what we should do is offer him a spot in the Summer Sanctum.
Well, that's a good point. Because I think I don't know whether we'd want him, though, because I'm not sure whether his English is good enough. He might be hard to listen to. But you'd maybe find a spot for him.
Squeeze him in.
That could be a bit of a... Maybe we get him a podcast.
Not so messy.
I thought that was quite funny.
Let's get him a go. RSN Digital, not so messy. 5 till 5:30 Thursday night on RSN 927.
Did you? Well, Scott Jamieson and him could have a duo. That go down quite well. Usain Bolt tested positive to COVID-19 after having a birthday party.
Did you hear about that? Yeah, I saw him. Actually, no, I did know that because I saw him recovering. He had a photo of himself. Took a photo of himself recovering. He was bound to get it, wasn't he? He's a party animal. He's out there with the peeps all the time.
Yes, but the interesting thing about that was it was not dissimilar to Novak Djokovic in the sense that he kind of thought that he could have a party and almost sort of make the point of being able to have one. And think that it was all okay, you know, a just try and make life normal again, and it didn't work out too well for him.
Yeah, no, he was a certainty. He was a $1.10, I reckon, because he likes the party. Yeah. That's his thing. Mm. So I'm not surprised by that at all, but yes, I hope he's okay. You saying what? One of the most phenomenal athletes we've ever seen on the planet. Remy Gardner is an Australian Moto 2 rider, and I've been tracking him down for the last couple of weeks, and we've finally got a hold of him. Remy, g'day.
G'day, mate. How's it going?
Good to be here. Going all right. Thank you, buddy. Great to have you on board. Now, just for our listeners, where are you currently?
I'm actually in Sitges, Spain. It's about 20 minutes south of Barcelona. So, yeah, that's actually where I reside.
And what time is it in the day?
It's 10:30, about something like that. Yeah, 10:20.
10:23 or somewhere around about that. Righto, so we've got that out of the way. I want to talk to you about your racing because I've been watching a fair bit of motorsport in the last little while. I don't mind the bikes. In fact, I quite like the bikes. And I saw you last week at the Austrian Grand Prix at the Red Bull Ring where you've had a couple of weeks together. And you got pole. And I was very excited about that, Remy. Was that your first pole last week?
No, that's not my first pole. Last year, the first pole would have been Assen. But yeah, definitely nice to have another pole under my belt.
Yeah, so you've had a pretty good start to the year. I mean, you started with a fifth and a seventh, and you're sort of down the track in the third and fourth races of the series, and then you get pole in Austria, and then you have a podium on the weekend. It's all coming together. Are you feeling this is the best you've been able to consistently put a race together for the Moto2?
No, for sure. This year's been a lot more consistent. You know, last year, we had the speed last year, but the consistency was definitely lacking. But no, this year, I found it's better to finish races and get the points and when the podiums come, take the podiums instead of forcing them. So definitely, it's off to a better start to this year than last year.
So is that a conversation? That's interesting you say that, because I was thinking about that. Is that a conversation you have with yourself, or is that something the team directs? Mate, just finish the race. You don't have to push so hard all the time because we often make mistakes when that happens. Is that a team conversation or one that you have with yourself?
I kind of had that with myself, to be honest. Last year, it was pretty obvious, to myself as well as to everyone. That's what we needed. And really, over the winter, I really worked hard on that aspect. And, we did really good testing in the preseason, and just approaching the races with a different mindset in the end.
Because one of the things they were talking about in the commentary for you last week in the Austrian Grand Prix was that you're riding on a bike that's perhaps a little bit inferior to some of the top crews around at the moment. We haven't got the latest and greatest bike, so your efforts at the moment are actually more impressive than perhaps they're showing. How hard is it to know that somebody else out there's got a better machine than you?
You just kind of have to accept the situation. There's no point in crying about it and complaining and making excuses. So I'm working really hard with the team and we're doing our best with what we got. And honestly, it's showing. There's honestly, like I said, there's no point in crying about it. You just got to make the best of what what you have, and definitely that podium I think showed everything that we're doing as a team really is paying off, So I think you just can't let that eat away at you in the head, you kind of just got to get on with the job and make it happen.
Yep.
How competitive is it, Remy, at this level? Obviously I'm sure you want to get to the highest level possible. But just navigating your way through, is it just fiercely competitive?
Yeah, it's extremely competitive. Very political too. A lot of money involved. it's not easy. It's you gotta snake your way through a minefield. It's very, very competitive, and especially Moto 2 as well. The level is extremely high, and you just really have to be on your game 24/7 and showing those results.
And so you live in Spain. Tell us the reasons why you live there, and is it all about trying to give yourself the best chance to succeed? I'm assuming, but tell us about that sort of experience.
Yeah, so we actually moved there nearly 9 years ago. That really was purely for racing. The level in Spain is a lot higher than anywhere in the world for juniors. And, I kind of stayed here as well, you know, because of the training as well. Once, you know, I made the move to MotoGP, the training here is incredible. We have many tracks, many different types of tracks. We've got karting, we've got motocross, dirt track. We've got everything. And it's all very, very close, very, very close to home. Easy to access, and like I said, the level here is incredible. So I made my life here. I've got a Spanish girlfriend and a dog, and you know, this is where I live now. So yeah.
Well, talk to us about the training, because we talked to Scotty McLaughlin, is a good friend of ours, and he speaks to us all the time about the training involved outside of the car to get him as fit as possible to be at the absolute top of his game. Talk to us about the things that you do to give yourself the best chance of succeeding, both on the bike and off the bike, you know, rather than just seeing you in the races we do when we watch you on television.
Yeah, most of the week I'm on the bike. At least three or four times I'm on the bike riding, at least whether it's trials or motocross or supermotard or dirt track. I'm going to be on the bike, you know. That's, for me, the best training for riding a bike is riding a bike. The other, you know, off days, I'm working in my workshop. I've got an old classic car. I'm working on my car. Well, I've got two classic cars. I work on them. That occupies a lot of time, and the other days I like to go spearfishing and wakeboarding, and I live near the ocean, which is good. And in between all that, go for a run, you know, get the cardio going. So I actually don't do much gym. I'm already too muscly and heavy as it is, to be honest, for Moto2. but yeah, you know, just like to keep active, keep on the bike, and keep things moving.
Well, let's get into legend territory while we can, because one of the things we do here on a Wednesday is find a legend in Australian sport and spend some time with them. Today we've got absolutely one of those. Played 325 games for the Cats, was the record holder until not too long ago. 203 goals as well. Three-time best and fairest, a leading goal kicker, captain and member of the Geelong Football Club Team of the Century, amongst a host of accolades. It's the one and only Ian Nankervis who joins us. Good morning, Ian.
Hi, good morning to you.
Now, am I right in saying, Ian, you've just got back from your morning run?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I've been part of my life, I guess, for a long time. And living in Queensland, the weather is suitable for a run in the morning, having a bit of a swim as well.
How far do you run every morning, Ian? I'm intrigued by this.
We live close to Mooloolaba Beach, and from one end of the beach to the other would be about 3 km, I suppose.
Good on you. That's fantastic. And when did you move up to Queensland?
We've been here since probably 1989. So we've been probably over 30 years or more.
Fantastic. It'd be a nice place to get up in the morning when the sun's shining like it normally is up there in Queensland. But we're talking today about your magnificent contribution to the Geelong Football Club. Back through your time, through your 325 games, it's an amazing career. Ian, do you get much chance to sit back and reflect on your contribution and those times?
From time to time, certainly you may go to a function and your record is spoken about, and so you do reflect a little bit. But from time to time, it's always a nice feeling as some people come up to you and they remember you playing and basically give you positive feedback. So I guess in times like that, you do reflect, it's just been something that I've never thought that I'd play. Hopefully you play one game, let alone 325. So at times, you're quite right, you do reflect and say, oh, well, it's been a great journey.
Well, it was a great journey. It started, in Bendigo, actually, which is my neck of the woods. But you played, obviously moved down to the beachside area and played a lot of your junior footy with Barwon Football Club. I'm sure when you were playing there, there was possibly a dream of playing in the AFL. Talk to us through how you went from playing at Barwon and you came to Geelong. What was that moment like?
Yes, well, that's right. I've played all my junior football with a Barn Football Club and went through to, at that stage, the under-18s. It was the last underage competition in the local comp, and then I had to make a decision whether I would go and play in the senior Barn side or go and play in the under-19s at Geelong. I got an invitation to go down and play, and at that stage, I was studying, and they were paying, I think, in those, they might have been £3 a week. So I could see that there was some way in which it could help me with a little bit of pocket money. And so I went to the under-19s, and I played four games with the under-19s and got promoted to the reserves after four games, and then continued to play all that year. Was put on the senior list, and then I played about 48 reserve games, and I thought that my opportunity may have slipped by because it didn't seem to get an opportunity, and I got a little bit of a break and played a game and continued in the side. So it was a long apprenticeship, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. And when you actually came into the Geelong environment, I mean, obviously things are very different now to what they would have been back then, but what were the biggest differences for you coming from, you know, your local footy club at Barwon coming into a club like Geelong?
Well, certainly mixing with players that you'd read about as a junior, and mixing with the likes of Doug Wade and Polly Farmer and so on, Billy Goggin. It was sort of a little bit of an unreal sort of situation for me, but I guess being into club rooms where they've got boot studders and all of those things that are laid on, it was certainly a lot changed now, but even then it was, I thought it was quite professional to go to a situation where, you know, they hand out socks and they hand out shorts and all of those things when you needed them. So that was certainly the first signs of being professional, I suppose, but it was just a great situation for me to be involved with those players that are, like I just mentioned.
So, and explain to us the change of role, because you were a really successful forward, a small forward, you played in the midfield, but then the move to the back pocket, which proved to be ultimately a huge success for you and for the Cats. Explain how that happened, because there's a bit of a story around that.
Yes, well, I always wanted to play on the ball, and in those days I played as a rover with the Barn Football Club, and then when I went to Geelong, they probably felt that I was a little bit too light and sort of was a half-forward flanker, and so I started playing a half-forward flank, and but when I got my opportunity at Geelong in the seniors, Gordon Hines was the second rover to Billy Goggin, and he sort of came down with a bit of a neck injury, and they put me on the ball and kicked a bit of a fluke goal against Hawthorn, and we won the game by less than a goal. So I sort of then got picked as a rover, second rover to Billy Goggin. And so when Billy retired, I took over the mantle as the number one rover for 10 years. And then Rod Olsen came to the club, and in that pre-season, I damaged an ankle, and he was looking, I suppose, to change people in various positions. And the situation was that the only position available after the practice match series was possibly in the back pocket. And so I found myself being selected in the back pocket, and which was totally different for anything that I'd played in junior football the last 10 years at Geelong. So it was also, I suppose, a bit of a desperate move to keep playing. And I found that with my fitness as an on-baller, I found it quite an easy adjustment to go from playing on the ball to playing in the back pocket. So it was really probably, as I understand it, a decision made by Rod Olsen and the match committee that maybe my experience could help out in the back pocket. If it worked, it'd be great. If not, well, it's probably my career was over, sort of thing. So fortunately for me, it continued.
And for a long time. So did you embrace it? Like, at the, I mean, you can reflect back on it now, but when it sort of happened, how did you accept it? And in a lot of ways, did you kind of, not necessarily revolutionise the position, but you were known for doing things a little bit differently, you know, kicking across goal, being a little bit more aggressive when you had the football, in trying to move the ball. Did you sort of, how did you sort of, what was your mindset like when you took on that responsibility?
Well, it's probably completely different in a way, because playing up forward, you tended to make your own breaks, and you didn't have to worry about looking after your opponent so much. But going into defence, and especially the last line of defence, one mistake and could cost you a goal. So the first thing was to try and make sure my opponent didn't get a kick. When I adjusted, I felt that in those days, what happened, the rover would come down for a rest in the forward pocket. And I thought, well, why give him a rest? And my fitness was such that I felt that I could just keep running and sort of create moves from defence. And the other thing is that at times the game used to get bottled up. And so my idea was that if we could perhaps change direction and give it to somebody who was free on the other side of the ground, and we get the ball out of defence. And really all I wanted to do was make sure the ball was away from my area so that goals couldn't be kicked on you. So that's sort of where it all evolved from, I guess. And then having played there and played with people like Gary Malarkey and Jack Hawkins and my brother Bruce at times on the halfback flank, it became a much easier game when those blokes were taking marks and I could perhaps create things from them. So that's really where it all came from, I guess.
Cameron White is part of the team here in the Breakfast Club, and he's decided after 20 years he's had a gut full of playing cricket. He's hanging up the spikes for the final time. Welcome to you, Whitey.
Morning, half.
Finally, Whitey, that's enough. What tipped you over?
Well, yeah, I think you said it in the intro there, half. I think I probably had enough. So once you get to that stage, yeah, it's just probably... Look, to be honest, I was never probably going to play again this season, but I did a little interview with my old friend Louis Cameron, who writes for cricket.com for Cricket Australia the other day, about the Sherrells Melbourne Stars, actually. And at the end of the interview, he asked me, you know, what I was up to next year. And I thought the whole interview was about, you know, the beginning of the Melbourne Stars and what was going on there and how that all went down. And then I just said, look, Louis, I'm probably not going to play again, mate. And, you know, I'll concentrate on coaching. And then the next thing, Adam White sending me out a tweet, and I'm officially retired. So it sort of slipped out a bit quicker than I was hoping for, to be honest with you.
So really, it was Adam White who retired you?
Oh, between Louis Cameron and Adam White, they've got me.
Right. Well, you're a disgrace. Yeah, well, like you.
I must confess, I was a bit surprised when I read the article, because I hadn't known that was definitely going to happen. So I thought it was all sort of stage managed, that was the case.
No, not at all. Not at all. It sort of snuck out. So Louis Cameron's done an absolute number on me there. But anyway, it had to come out at some stage.
Right.
Oh, my God.
Well, there you go. A bit speechless. Do you are you happy that you went and did that year at the Adelaide Strikers? Because obviously it was part of the process of, I guess, the transition from player to coach to get into a different environment. It didn't quite work out, but are you happy you did do that?
Well, it probably didn't work out for me from a playing point of view personally, but I think it did from a coaching point of view. Like, part of my role there was to do a bit of coaching, and I really enjoyed that, and I think the players did as well. So and I think I will probably need to do something like that if I want to continue on coaching. I can't, you know, sit here in Victoria for my whole career and think that, you know, that I can't experience, you know, a different, you know, set of people or a different environment. So I think hopefully that'll hold me in good stead sort of going forward, you know, hopefully getting into some coaching at some stage.
Was there a moment, Cameron, that you knew that it was time to retire? I mean, obviously, maybe the way it was announced was a little bit different. I assume that you had some thoughts about it before that happened in that article. Was it your body? Was it you just had enough and you're ready to go on to something else? What was it that tipped you over the edge to that decision?
I think probably as I got a bit the last couple of years of my career, you know, when you're standing out in the field, especially in a Shield game, and the opposition are none for 250 or there, you know, especially when you're second or third day into the field, you've got nothing else to think about. You start thinking, oh, geez, what else could I be doing here? But, you know, little did I know that we were about to go into our second one of stage four lockdown, so maybe I should have tried to keep playing a little bit.
What is top of the list when you were out in the field thinking, what else could I be doing? What were the top couple of things?
Well, fishing goes straight to the top of the list for me most of the time.
Fishing?
It's not fishing, it's probably golf, that's what I know. But,
Right. Well, yeah, there'll be plenty of time for that now.
Well, I'm not allowed to, yeah.
Well, that's true, yeah, of course. Of course. How are you keeping busy? If you can't fish and you can't play golf and you're not cricketing, how are you coping with all this?
Well, luckily my wife works a few days a week from home, so I'm daddy daycare most of the week these days, and then I'm actually doing the odd day or two on the tools for a mate that's a builder, so I'm actually enjoying that. So it's going right.
Right. Okay. Good. Yeah. Good.
Just the real good jobs half, like just a bit of labouring, picking up, on the wheelbarrow, shovel most of the day, digging holes, real good stuff.
Honest toil.
And the best thing is the Breakfast Club is being played on the construction site. I'm sure.
I would assume so. I assume so.
When you look back, Cam, what is it that you're most proud of? Because we talked about how much you've won, and a lot of that. When you've won, you've been a key part of that from a leadership perspective. You've been able to play for your country. You've broken all sorts of records domestically with what you've been able to do. What's the thing that stands out when you reflect back?
I think just the times you win, you play to win, championships or trophies and things like that. So any of those sort of Sheffield Shield finals, the bigger games that you get to play in along your career that you sort of, you play well in and win and your team wins. So, yeah, just probably the moments, obviously, the obvious ones, playing for Australia and representing your country. So, things you'll never forget. But, most of the time it's just those, the great wins that you have with your teammates and celebrating after. That's a great part of, sport in Australia. And it was no different when I played my time playing cricket.
Tim is training at the gymnasium owned by Chris Condon. He's one of the judges, and he was in the corner with Costa Zoo in his corner. He was a corner man, so we were aware of that relationship, which I wasn't completely comfortable with, that relationship, of course. But I thought, well, one out of three isn't the end of the world. But, when I heard about the second judge saying to people that he believed Tim would win the fight, that concerned me. I don't like judges going into a fight with a preconceived view of the outcome of the fight.
Well, that'd be a setback with a preconceived view of the outcome. That's Glenn Rushton, the trainer for Jeff Horn, who is getting ready for tonight's big fight, massive fight in Australian boxing between Jeff Horn and Tim Tsu. And Glenn Rushton, got a few people offside with those comments too, just by the way, looking for this super welterweight clash tonight. Paul Upham knows more about it than we will ever know. And he's a Fox Sports boxing analyst and joins us again on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, team.
What was Glenn Rushton on about there?
Well, look, he's tried to make a few points. He's known about this for weeks and weeks. He could have lodged an official complaint with the sanctioning bodies. He decided not to. At the rules meeting yesterday, he was asked whether he wanted to lodge a complaint. He was backtracked and said he didn't want to. So I'm not exactly sure why he said that. Maybe he's trying to put a bit of influence onto the judging, but it's unfortunate, but the people making the decisions, you have to trust in their integrity and their decision making. You've got three Queensland judges there. Jeff Horn's from Queensland, and they've had to pick judges locally because of the pandemic. And ultimately, hopefully we don't need the judge's decision and somebody wins by knockout, and that avoids any controversy post-fight.
It's billed as one of the biggest clashes in Australian domestic boxing for years and years and years. Does it fit that billing? And because we've got Jeff Horn, who's former world champ, 32 years of age. We've got Tim Tsu, who's undefeated in 15 fights. He's 25 and on the up. Is it the fight we need?
Look, it is, because any time you have 16,000 people outdoors at a venue like that in Townsville, it's great for boxing. This fight's going to be shown live around the world. And it's not only good for Tim Zhu and Jeff Horn, whoever wins, it's also good for Australian boxing because it shows the world, hey, we've got live boxing down here with crowds, we can put big fights on, and whoever wins is going to go into a world title fight and say, look, let's host it down here because we can put big fights on. So, look, it's great for Australian boxing, great opportunity for all the boxers on the undercard to try and make a name for themselves. And, yeah, it's a fight we need because, you know, this pandemic's been terrible for so long, and now let's have some big fight action and it's a close fight. So I'm looking forward to it.
So one of the things I've heard Jeff Horn talk about, and I know there's a lot of smack talk at the beginning of a fight always, but he's saying that the only reason Tim Zhu's got this fight is because of his father, of course, we all know, Kostya Zhu. Is that just talk, or is there, you know, is there a bit of that, the name that follows him?
It is correct to a certain extent, because it wouldn't be such a big fight if it was Joe Smith. You wouldn't have 16,000 people outdoors at Townsville. But Tim Zhu has still won 15 fights, undefeated. He's looked really good in doing so. He's beaten guys going up the ladder to earn the fight with Jeff Horn. But, yeah, look, it's a bigger fight, certainly, because of the Zhu name. There's no doubt about that.
I was surprised that Jeff said that, because Jeff isn't really into that sort of thing. He usually just lets his actions do the talking. We've spoken to Jeff a number of times, and he just seems like a lovely man. So is that... is that part of, as Sherelle said, that's just the talk, or is that that he feels he needs to perhaps get in the mind of his opposition here?
He is a lovely man, and he doesn't normally do trash talk. He doesn't come across well as a trash talker, per se. And
no.
Look, I think it's Tim Zhu. Like, they think he's coming across as arrogant by the way he thinks he says, I'm going to win this fight and I'm going to move on to bigger world title fights. They think it's disrespectful to Jeff. But what it is, it's the true belief that Tim has in his ability to win. He has no doubt. The old Australian fighter, Vic Tarchinian, used to be criticised as being arrogant, but Vic was never arrogant. He was just totally believing in his ability. And a top line in boxing, when it comes to Horn versus Zhu, you have to believe in your ability to win fights.
And who's more suited to this bout from what you can see, Paul? Jeff's a little bit ungainly at times. Tim's got some really fast hands. Who's got the upper hand, do you think, in this bout?
Look, on paper, Jeff Horn should be the favourite. He should win the fight. He's got the more experience. He's got fantastic punching power, great endurance, great ability. Tim is certainly working his way up. We're not sure if he's ready for this level yet. The biggest question mark I've got is, in the recent fights, Jeff Horn's had a lot of eye cuts. And once you start getting that, it's very hard to stop it happening again. So I'm concerned during the fight, if Tim Zhu can open up those cuts, it's going to make it hard for Jeff to win the rounds, because the perception will be that Tim's winning those rounds. It's only a 10-round fight. You only need 6 rounds to win. So, look, I think Jeff Horn is the better fighter going into this match, but it's all for Tim Zhu to prove. Is he as good as some people think he is?
Well, where was Jeff, though? In the weigh-in, he was called to the stage and he was nowhere to be found. Where was he? Is that something that happens quite a bit? Or was that staging? Or what happened there? Where was he?
I think that's the suggestion, that Jeff, you know, really has to work hard to get down to that weight limit at 69 kilos. These boxers at the elite level, they try and cut, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 kilos in the last couple of weeks to get down, to shrink themselves down, to get to the weight class, and then they bulk themselves up over that 24, 30 hours later. So the suggestion was that Jeff was in the sauna, you know, getting down the weight, and look, that's what compromised him in America when he lost to Terence Crawford. He really couldn't make the welterweight limit anymore.
Yep.
So when he came to fight night, he just had nothing left. I think he'll be okay tonight, and I think Tim Zhu, you know, is a natural super welterweight, but it's the fact that the boxers have to cut a lot of weight in the last couple of weeks to get down to that weight class.
Head into the colours of the brown and the gold team, the Hawks. Isaac Smith is our man who helps us out with all the information from inside the four walls of the Mighty Hawthorne Football Club. He's back again this morning. Good morning, Isaac.
Morning, Half. How are you?
Going very well, thank you. But the bigger question is, how are you? Because on the AFL website, it says to me, Isaac Smith, this is the injury report, by the way, shoulder, 1 to 2 weeks. What's happening?
Are we 1 to 2 weeks?
Well, that's what it said, but I know that you know different.
I have not read the AFL website or the injury report, so... yeah, it's funny what that sometimes says to what's actually happening, but, I'll miss this week, and hopefully it'll be right for next week, but we'll just wait and see.
Righto. So, it's obviously getting better. How are you treating it at the moment? What's the rehab process for you?
I'm a biggest... running session yesterday and got moving and got the arm moving a fair bit over the last sort of 3 or 4 days. So it's tracking along nicely. And originally when it all happened, it was touted for 2 to 4 weeks, and it's only been sort of 15 days since it happened. So, yeah, we're tracking along nicely.
Are you a bit... I saw you on the weekend with your crazy mates standing by the side of the road with strats written on six of your chests, S-T-R-A-T-S, and with an exclamation mark, I think, on the chest and on the back, 200 with a lot of exclamation marks, as a bit of a show of support for Ben Stratton because you couldn't be there. Who came up with that idea?
I'd have to put my hand up, man. Another guy. we're sitting, maybe sampling a Barossa wine one of the nights, and decided that that'd be a good idea, and it caused a bit of fun and gave us an hour of enjoyment in the hub. So it was awesome, and we're pretty disappointed that we weren't able to attend Stratos 200. And most of us have played, I think, in that group, other than maybe Cicely and Segler had played 200 games, and we'd all been able to go out there and play. And support our mate that's been able to do it. So it was disappointing, and we've played 10 years of footy with him and won 3 flags together. So it was awesome just to be able to give him a bit of a send-off, and they said it gave him a fair bit of a lift as they were driving into the ground, which was good.
Well, they put up a good show on the weekend against the Power. Of course, they're top of the ladder, and it's not quite that situation for the Hawks at the moment. Were you impressed with what you saw from the boys on the weekend?
Yeah, it was disappointing we couldn't get the win, but there were certainly some impressive signs, and it was good to see we could get the ball moving. And in their shortened game, scoring early is imperative, and I think they got 2 or 3 goals up initially, which when it's sort of only 50, 60-point games of football, it's keeping you in the game of football the whole game. So, yeah, it was really impressive. It was good to see some... guys get a go. Daniel Howe's had a tough run with injury over the last 12 months, and he got back in, and I thought he made us a better side. James Cousin looked really good. Michael Hartley looked good down back, and there were some good signs from a few of the other younger guys as well.
One of the things that photo showed, Isaac, was just how much experience is actually out of the team at the moment. So has it felt that the sort of the pressure is off a little bit now, that it is now just about investigating what's on the list and what might be possible for next year and beyond?
Not necessarily. I think as a player, every time you go out, you expect to win, and you certainly hope to win. Obviously, there's been mentions from people at the club that they want to see what's on the list and see how that evolves. Which needs to be done, and I think we've seen some great signs over the last few weeks, but does that lower the expectation of the boys that are running out there? I probably don't think so. But, yeah, we certainly played a really good team on the weekend, and it was always going to be hard to get the win, especially at their home ground, which is our home ground now. But, yeah, it was good to see the boys put up a really good fight, and it was actually really enjoyable to watch.
The reason I ask that question is I reckon at times against Fremantle, but certainly against Port Adelaide, that the shackles seemed off. The ball movement was a lot better, it was a lot more aggressive, and it was more the Hawthorn that we kind of expect, even though there was so much experience out of the team.
Yeah, I think we've probably released the shackles in the last couple of weeks, Whitey, and we've certainly been doing a fair bit of education around our ball movement and what we'd like to see. And you're 100% right. You get a few younger guys in there, you tell them just to get going, and certainly the ball movement looked a lot more effective on the weekend, and we looked a lot more dangerous. So hopefully we can continue that trend.
There seemed to be some glimpses, and correct me if I'm wrong, but from Jonathan Patton, and he's missed a lot of footy this year, and he's a new recruit and hasn't quite worked out to this point, but I'm interested just in your views on him and what he could be for Hawthorn, because, as I said, there just seem to be some glimpses of what might be of Jonathan Patton in a Hawthorn jumper.
Yeah, I think the hard thing for Patto is that he hasn't been able to get any continuity in his footy in the 10 years that he's been in the league. I think him and I were talking the other day. I've been in the league one more year than him, and I've played 210 games or something, and I think he's around 80 or 90, so... It just shows you how much footy he's missed through injury. And I think the biggest thing for him is he's obviously got a lot of talent and he knows how to play football. He wouldn't have went number one otherwise. But He just needs some continuity, and yeah, you're 100% right. On the weekend, we saw some great signs, and I know he didn't kick a goal, but in the majority of his contests on the weekend, he was 2v1, and he created a lot of opportunities for Luke Bruce and Chad Wingard and Ollie Henrahan and blokes like that. So, yeah, it was certainly positive signs, and I think if John can just play the last few games of this season and then play a full season next year, you'll start to see the best of him.
Well, that'd be great for him, but for Hawthorn fans as well, to see a big power forward roaming the forward line for the Hawks in the next, hopefully, 5 to 8 years or so for a big John Patton. You mentioned the Adelaide Oval being your home ground before. You're in the Baroth, sir, at the moment, doing your hub thing.
Played there on the weekend. You got sunny this morning.
Yeah, it's not bad here either, just by the way, which we're happy about. You've got the Bombers tomorrow night at the Adelaide Oval. Do you get to train there, or is that out of bounds?
No, that's out of bounds, half. We're training at Central District's home ground, which is nice. They're accommodating us at the moment. I think Clarko used to be the head coach there, and Jack Gunston continues to remind us that he was a premiership player there. So we're getting down to the Oval. It's a bloody big Oval. I've had to run it the last few days, and it's 520 metres a lap. So
that's the size
of the old Waverley. So I did 3 laps yesterday. That was a 1500 metre and 80 effort.
What time did you do, just by the way?
I don't use watches, use the sun.
You idiot. So what's, for Hawthorn fans listening, what's left in this season? It's obviously 5 games, but what's left to achieve for this season? Well, he didn't like that question.
Well, it's a tough question.
Well, it is, but he's not there. He's dropped off, which is unfortunate. He's too busy running around that 520-metre oval. He's back, is he? You're back?
Yeah, sorry, guys. I don't know what happened there.
That's all right. That's okay. I'm not sure if you heard the question or not, but what are we trying to achieve last 5 games of the season for the Hawks? What's left? Is it trialling some things? Is it new movement patterns? Is it new players? Or is it just going full steam ahead with the best possible squad to win 5 games on the way home?
I think, what's ahead? Certainly we've got 5 winnable games. Lost some games we certainly should have won this year. We've lost against teams that we believe we should have beaten, but the last 5 games of the year, we've certainly got winnable games and we'll be going out to win them. I think you'll see some of the younger guys injected into the team. There's probably guys, as you saw on the weekend, that have been carrying a few injuries over the last few weeks that might be probably sitting out for 1 or 2 games. We had that on the weekend, and we'll be taking fit blokes into the games and hopefully getting the win, which would be great for not only the players playing and the people that are in the hub away, but also the Hawks fans and pretty much everyone that signed up for a membership this year has hung on and stuck fat with us. So I know it's probably been disappointing for them. It's certainly been disappointing for us, but hopefully we can get some wins to thank them for their support.
Yeah, I'm sure they'd absolutely love that. It kicks off tomorrow night. Adelaide Oval, the old rival, 4:40 p.m. Check your local guides. That's an unusual time for a match of football.
Yeah, whoever thought Hawthorn v Essendon would be the curtain raiser? Knocked me over with a feather when I saw it.
It's a ripping night of football, though. Hawthorn, Essendon, and then Richmond and Eagles is...
it is a cracking night of footy.
We're not playing our best footy. That's clear and obvious to everyone. But we find a way to get through, and we challenged ourselves. Hawthorn challenged us, and we still found a way to get the 4 points, which was really important.
Not playing our best footy, says Kenny, but still sitting top of the table. We're going okay there at the Power, and one of the reasons is because Tom Rockliffe is in a hot form in the middle of the ground, and he played his 200th game on the weekend as well, and he's been able to join us on the Breakfast Club. Tom, congratulations. Good morning.
Thank you. As Kenny said, we're not playing our best footy, but we feel like we've got a bit of improvement left in us to really push hard towards the back end of the season.
Must be nice to be not playing your best footy and sitting atop the table, Tom.
Well, I think we were playing some really good footy even a few weeks ago, and then Geelong gave us a bit of a shake-up the previous week, and then it was a real scrap against Hawthorn. So there's a few things that we can tinker with to improve our game, and I think every team is trying to improve themselves at this time of year, particularly the ones that are either situated in finals or just outside to give themselves the best opportunity to play finals.
How much assessment of that Geelong game was there? Because, as you say, they put on a bit of a show and took you to the cleaners a little bit, and it was a test against a real good opposition that went haywire from your end. And it's been really one of the only disappointing performances of the year. So you've done a great job. But how much assessment and review of that was there as to how to get better going forward and put yourself in a chance to win a premiership?
It was one of those ones where we would have liked to put no break so we could have gone out there and performed again, but the way it fell, it was an 8-day break, so we put a lot of time into it, reviewed it pretty heavily, and where we could have got better, and we just went down to the fundamentals. I think Geelong beat us at the contest. They got back and outnumbered front of Charlie Dixon and our forwards, and then transferred the ball to the open side, really controlled it by foot, and then stretched us defensively and gave Tom Hawkins and their key forwards one-on-ones inside 50, which we weren't able to do. So there was plenty of lessons to be learned out of it, offensively and defensively and in the contest. So I think when we get the opportunity to play Geelong again, which hopefully we will towards in finals, it'll give us a good opportunity, and I think we've learned some really good lessons out of it.
So what happens in that situation, Tom, in the sense of, does it worry you that a team that you are likely to face in the finals touches you up, or is it not necessarily a good thing, but it happened early enough in the season that you now know the adjustments you need to make?
Yeah, I think we'd like to think that we'd learn from that and take the adjustments out of it. I think that there's definitely plenty of lessons, as I said, to be learned out of it. I think most teams have had a performance this year which I'd rather forget. We'd like to think that was ours, and we take the lessons out of it, move forward, get back to playing Port Adelaide style, which we know holds up really well. We beat Richmond the week before in a really good contest that we felt like was a real good, solid Port Adelaide brand of footy, and just kind of try and continue to get better as a team, and also just play our style and get the footy in our good users' hands. Darcy Byrne-Jones and guys like that have had really good seasons off punt back, so if we can get it through our users and then get it going forward, we can use it a lot better and make sure that we use targets going forward.
I'm interested in Ken Hinckley behind the scenes, because he's someone that we love listening to, because he's a very positive coach publicly. He seems to really encourage you to take the game on and play, as you say, the Port Adelaide way. What's he been like behind the scenes, particularly as you start to get close to finals?
Yeah, Kenny's he's pretty positive on that front, but there's no doubt that when the hard conversations need to be had, he's not afraid to have them as well and tell us that it wasn't good enough and what we need to get better at. So there's no doubt that he gets the balance right, make sure that we're on edge and ready to go and not looking too far ahead. We've got a really good challenge on the weekend down here against Sydney, and we haven't looked too far ahead, but he makes sure that we learned some lessons out of the Hawthorn game, particularly defensively. We feel like we're giving up goals from too easy a spot at the moment. So we've got to just continue to work on our team defense. It's not just a back six. So he's been pretty strong on that this week, and he's really good. He sees the game really well and gives the guys feedback, whether it be positive or negative. And I think all the guys understand that he's coming from the right place and he just wants us to get better as a team.
You've got a great run home, and I know you're not looking games ahead, but just the spacing of the games, Tom, really seems to have come into your favour. You play Saturday games for the rest of the season. You've got 7-day breaks between each game, which I imagine no other team, I haven't thoroughly looked at it, I must admit, but no other team would have in the competition. How big a bonus is that going to be, do you think, freshening up into a finals campaign?
Yeah, we feel like we've done a lot of the heavy lifting early. Obviously, up in the hub, and then we travelled up to Queensland a couple of times the day of the game. Had a 6 a.m. flight, so I feel like we did a fair bit of lifting through that early part of the season. Then we had a couple of 4-day breaks in there as well. So it's worked out well. The back end of the draw there, that we get, I think, one of those games we have a bye in between, so it just ends up being a 7-day break. So nothing really changes for us. So as I touched on before, we've got areas of our game that we want to improve and get better at. With having 7-day breaks, it probably gives us an opportunity to train a couple of times a week to work on them, but also then we've got four more performances before where we want to get to. So we've got a really good little period coming up, and as I said, it starts with Sydney this weekend, and if we play the right way and play the way that we want to play, then hopefully we can really build some momentum heading towards finals.
I mentioned before that you're in pretty hot form at the moment, and you've gone through this period of play. You've obviously compressed schedule and the like. Are you surprised with how well you're feeling and playing, considering the calendar and how hard it's been on a lot of bodies across the competition?
Yeah, it's probably a little blessing in disguise. Looking back now, when I did get dropped from the team, that the body probably got an opportunity to freshen up over those 2 or 3 weeks. And my body feels really good now. So I'm not sure how it would have gone if I played all the games through the season, yeah, then done the quick 4-day break, 5-day breaks. But my body at the moment feels really good. So as I touched on, we've got 7-day breaks for the rest of the season. So it's sort of just a normal type run-in for us now. And I'd like to think that I play all the games and continue, and hopefully continue my strong form towards the back half of the year.
Well, you've got a fair bit of motivation attached to it, because finals, I know you're desperate to play them. It's a pretty big pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, at the end of this home and away season for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think everyone through their footy career, you play to win, and I've played in a final in my 200 games to date. There's certainly, as you said, a big pot of gold at the end of that. So there's even more motivation. But I think you look across our group, and we've got a few older guys that are sort of getting to that point in their career where it's sort of now or never. Robbie Gray's a little bit older, Bokey's the same, Westhoff, Ebert, you can even throw probably Hartlett. Jonas is towards the back end of his career as well. So we know the importance of it, and to live in the moment. And right here, right now, we feel like we've got a really good opportunity. And if we can play, as I said before, the Port Adelaide style and play our way, we feel like we can do some damage come finals time.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.